At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
All things being equal, we might be able to take today's uplifting report on a bump up in economic growth, balance that with today's discouraging word on dropping home sales, and reconcile the data with what might normally be expected. Except for something economists are having trouble factoring in. This winter has been anything but normal. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the new Harvard Business Review, a source of smart thinking for today's business world. The revival of smart begins at hbr.org. And by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. And we made it to Friday, this 26th of February, which is no small feat given the harsh weather from coast to coast. From winter's third strike in the east to new flash flood worries from yet another storm moving in here in soggy L.A. It's even making life tougher on economists who make a living deciphering the numbers, because the weather is having an increasing impact on the economy's performance. Marketplace's John Dimsdale explains.
As the guy who keeps tabs on housing numbers for IHS Global Insight, Pat Newport is a big fan of the National Climatic Data Center.
Since it's my job, I look at their site every month.
And Newport says it's been a weird winter weather-wise.
October was the third coolest and the wettest October that we've had in the 115 years that the government has been tracking the numbers. November was the third warmest and 18th driest. Then December was the 14th coldest and the 11th wettest. Now we're in February and we're having three winter storms.
When it's too wet or cold to build homes, construction jobs are put off.
I don't think we're going to get a good reading on housing for maybe not until April.
At which time Newport predicts a burst of hiring to meet a backlog of demand for new houses. Meanwhile, transportation is disrupted, shoppers stay home, and local governments are slapped with cleanup costs. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke was asked about the weather at a congressional hearing yesterday. He doesn't expect any long-term effects on the economy, but he is looking for a temporary spike in unemployment.
So we'll have to be particularly careful about not overinterpreting the data that we receive for January.
Some analysts say if the economy is this susceptible to changes in the weather, the recovery is on very thin ice. And the murky data could make the Fed's job of spotting economic trends more difficult, just as it's trying to decide when to unwind its easy money policies. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Just about no one escaped the credit crunch during the recession, but small businesses really got squeezed. Credit lines called in, credit cards canceled, and bank loans reduced or unavailable. Lending fell more last year than at any time since 1942, according to the FDIC. Making things worse, as of this week, the Small Business Administration has run out of stimulus funding to guarantee bank loans on favorable terms. At a House hearing today, legislators grilled bankers and regulators on what they plan to do to jumpstart lending. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has more.
The SBA has spent the $500 million it got from the stimulus last year. The money was used to bolster guarantees and reduce fees on bank loans that it backs for small businesses. The House put funding in its jobs bill to extend the program through September, but the Senate left the provision out. Now anxious business owners are waiting for Congress to act. Larry Nanis is a CPA in Massachusetts and incoming chair of the National Small Business Association.
If the economy starts to turn around and this thing doesn't happen for the next 3, 4, 5, 6 months, there are going to be a number of our small businesses poised to expand, and there isn't going to be any lending for them.
The president has another idea: pump $30 billion in bank bailout money into community lenders.
Putting that money back in the hands of the community bankers, who seem to be the ones who are more likely to lend than some of the larger bankers, makes a lot of sense.
Some Democratic lawmakers want to go one step further. They say, why not let government lend directly to small businesses and eliminate the banker middleman altogether? Economist Jane DeRista at the University of Massachusetts says this worked during the Great Depression.
But then, are you going to get that past the people in the Congress who are leery of big government? I don't know.
SBA officials say they have no interest in becoming a bank for small businesses. They say they don't have the staff or underwriting expertise to do the job. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Climate change legislation has stalled in Congress, though there are some Senate mutterings it could be resurrected soon. Starting next year, the Environmental Protection Agency is proposing to regulate greenhouse gas emissions through the Clean Air Act. Several business groups and utilities oppose that, and one association has backed efforts to block the EPA. But as Jennifer Collins reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, it turns out that association doesn't speak for all its members.
The American Public Power Association touched off quite a flurry. This week, the trade group urged lawmakers to bar the EPA from regulating greenhouse gases. Then, some lawmakers said association members complained of misrepresentation, so they told the trade group to basically back off.
Well, we're going to formally respond.
Nick Braden is with the association. He says this is all about who should regulate greenhouse gases. He wants Congress to pass the rules, not the EPA.
We just believe that legislation is the better vehicle.
We don't see things the same.
Lynn Best is with association member Seattle City Light. She says the question is how fast to regulate.
It looks like the legislation is going to take, unfortunately, a pretty long time, and we think this is too urgent and it's too vital to wait.
She says global warming is drying up snow that feeds their hydroelectric dams. So the faster greenhouse gases are regulated, the better. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
Wow, what a month on Wall Street. And we'll have the details when we do the numbers. Have you heard? The story of the Enron scandal is headed for Broadway. Yep, starting in April. But maybe they'll want to do some rewrites between now and then, because the story might not be over. The company's CEO, Jeffrey Skilling, is serving a 24-year federal prison sentence in one of the country's biggest accounting fraud cases. But on Monday, the Supreme Court is set to hear his appeal, and the justices could yet overturn a widely used statute that was key to convicting Skilling. As Brett Neely reports, the decision could have a big impact on corporate crime cases.
The Supreme Court took Skilling's appeal because it's interested in the Honest Services Statute. It was originally used to fight government corruption, but prosecutors now use it against businesses. Tom Adjemi is a lawyer in Houston.
It's basically used anytime there's some type of a corporate fraud, saying that, well, what the employee was doing really wasn't providing honest services, and see, the evidence here is that there was a fraud.
Defense lawyers argue the law is too vague and lets prosecutors go after suspects with much weaker evidence than other fraud statutes. Robert Mintz is a former federal prosecutor in New Jersey.
On its face, there are people who will argue that you would actually deprive your employer of honest services merely by taking an unauthorized day off.
The Skilling case is one of three similar cases before the Supreme Court this term. Another involves the convicted newspaper publisher Conrad Black. It's unusual for the court to take so many similar cases, which means there could be a major ruling. Melanie Sloan of the group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington says the court shouldn't reverse.
There may be cases where honest services fraud has been applied too broadly, but neither the Black case nor the Skilling case are those cases.
She says a reversal will weaken the fight against corporate crime. If the Supreme Court does overturn some or all of the honest services statute, Jeff Skilling could be set free or face a retrial. In Washington, I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
We can expect news on President Obama's next move on health care reform probably by the middle of next week. The White House said today an announcement is likely then on what it calls the way forward. That follows yesterday's big health care face-off, summit, that is, hosted by the president. There was also lots of buzzing in Washington this week over the Fed chief's semiannual testimony on monetary policy. Joining us for the weekly wrap on Wall Street and beyond is Megan McArdle of The Atlantic Magazine. Hi, Megan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And economist Mike Mandel, who is also editor-in-chief of Visible Economy. Hi, Mike.
Glad to be here.
So there was a lot of talk, a lot of anticipation about Ben Bernanke's appearance on the Hill this week, that he was going to raise interest rates. Not much changed, though. Was this a lot of sound and fury signifying nothing, Mike?
The problem that the Fed has right now is that they have a patient that's on life support. The other doctor, that is fiscal policy, has left the room. And meanwhile, they're worried that if they started raising rates, that something horrible would come out from under the bed.
Megan, what was your takeaway?
Well, you know, I think that what Bernanke has been doing is sort of the Winston Churchill quote. You know, this is not the end. It is not even the beginning of the end, but it may perhaps be the end of the beginning.
Uh-huh.
And I actually think that that's a good thing. You know, what Bernanke wants to do is project a sense of credible inflation hawkery. He wants to be the guy with a plan, but he doesn't want to enunciate, you know, this plan is going to commence, 6 months hence for a couple of reasons. First of all, the economy still is, as Mr. Mandel says, on life support. And second of all, you know, you don't want to give people a deadline by which they should do whatever financial arcane manipulations they're planning to.
Okay, let's switch gears to what was supposed to be the main event in D.C. this week, the healthcare summit. Lots of discussion there. But to keep this on the money, let's review the current bill on the table. Does it really do enough to control costs, do you think, Mike?
I think that what this bill does is it does a nice but clunky job of expanding coverage. It does very little to control costs. And as Megan has heard before, this is just fine with me. Something needs to break the gridlock on health care. This bill, if it was pushed forward, would break the gridlocks. But no, this bill is not designed to cut costs.
Megan, what I heard from the Republicans was this is not going to cut costs. Do you agree with that?
I think that no one really thinks that this is a major cost-cutting bill. And the people who were sort of wanly saying that it was were, you know, it was a way to sell a bill that's got a big price tag on it that scares a lot of people. I think coverage is the ultimate goal.
Mike, are you suggesting that the politicians in Washington are not telling us the truth about cost controls here?
No, I'm actually suggesting that the politicians in Washington are trying to do something which is good, and they're concealing under weird speech. As Megan says, the ultimate goal is coverage. For some reason, the Democrats have kind of got themselves locked into the cost control theme here, and this bill doesn't do it. But the fact of the matter is they could push it through, and then they could actually run going forwards on, we've expanded coverage, we've made sure that you 55-year-old person who is getting laid off is not going to be stuck without health care. I think they could discover that if they pass this bill themselves, it could be very powerful for them.
Megan, don't they run the risk, though, the Democrats, of making the Republicans so upset about this ram-through approach that further gridlock is possible on anything else that they want to pass?
You know, I honestly don't think that the, you know, Republican anger over X, Y, or Z is the issue. The issue is that it is very safe for Republicans to filibuster this because 51 to 55% of the population of the United States is against it and only about 35 to 40% are for it. So, you know, I don't think that, you know, putting the fear of God into Republicans by jamming this through is going to be an effective strategy for the Democrats, because then the odds are that they're going to lose both the House and the Senate in the fall. And that's really tough. So now you've got the president and he can't do anything because you ram this through. Now, maybe that is worth it to do this bill. But like, don't kid yourself that if that happens, that's going to give you some sort of political capital to do other things. What it's actually going to do is make it much more likely that the Republicans are in power starting in January.
Megan McArdle of The Atlantic Magazine and Mike Mandel of Visible Economy, thank you both for joining us.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
Coming up, what's lost when forests are saved?
I wasn't there in the early go, but I would imagine we came in, as American companies frequently do. Everybody get out of the way. We're going to do this.
But first, let's do the numbers. Well, never mind the music. It was a lackluster day, really. Lousy week, but a very good month. The Dow ended just about where it began today, gaining a fraction of a percent or 4 points to close at 10,325. The NASDAQ picked up a tenth of a percent or 4 points to finish at 2,238. The S&P 500 also put on a tenth of a percent. That's 1 point to close out the day at 1,104. The week wasn't nearly as good. The Dow slipped 0.7%. The NASDAQ gave back 0.3%. The S&P forfeited 0.4%. This being the last day of trading for February, though, we've got the monthlies, and the Dow rose 2.6%. The S&P clicked up 2.9%, their biggest gain since November. The NASDAQ charged up 4.2%, its best monthly showing since December. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com. By the new Harvard Business Review, a source of smart thinking for today's business world. The revival of smart begins at hbr.org. And by Microsoft, offering cloud computing for businesses with solutions for managing the transition to the cloud while managing costs for customers at microsoft.com/cloud services. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll find Marketplace, The Morning Report, Marketplace Money, and more, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. In Washington, the Commerce Department lets us know how much money we pocketed and how much left our wallet in January. Let's move. That's the message from First Lady Michelle Obama. She'll speak to the School Nutrition Association about her campaign to tackle childhood obesity. Wondering what next month is? You may notice it in your supermarket. It's National Frozen Food Month. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. It wasn't so long ago that a Wall Street career was the holy grail of a large proportion of college students. But that was before the fall of Bear Stearns, the collapse of Lehman Brothers, and the near ruin of the financial system. Which brings us to our series on young people and Wall Street. The first installment could be heard earlier today on the Marketplace Morning Report, and it's on our website. Now, Youth Radio's Lauren Silverman describes why, for her, the towers of high finance no longer beckon.
A few years ago, I secretly dreamed about working on Wall Street. I used to picture myself in a pinstripe business suit, strutting past the charging bull before the opening bell. Working there seemed cool. It was like working for the company that makes the BlackBerry, before the iPhone, or working for Enron, before the bankruptcy. I remember one day, it was August of 2009, right before the crash. I was interning for a big nonprofit. I went out to meet up with some friends who all worked in the same field as I did. And then I met a girl who was in a whole other world. She had an internship with Goldman Sachs. I tried not to choke on my coffee. Goldman Sachs was my Lady Gaga. She was working on some big corporate buyout. But of course, she couldn't say much. The information was classified. She got to work at 7 a.m. each day, and from the way she talked about stock analysis, I imagined she knew how to use Bloomberg Analytics like an elementary school calculator. To me, she was the queen bee. And I was just one of her workers. Then the bailouts happened, and I changed my mind about Wall Street like that. I remember watching the bailouts and bonuses fiasco from my desk with the other interns on TV and yelling at the screen. We were furious. I mean, red in the face. Those companies seemed to throw around money like paper airplanes. Employees got their bonuses for losing big, and they didn't seem to care about the risks they took. Now, I know things are getting a bit better for the finance industry. I know banks have paid back some of the government bailout money. I know some investment firms are hiring again. But there's a permanent cloud lurking over Wall Street and a bad taste that's still in my mouth. I don't feel envious about those queen bees anymore. Chasing the Wall Street dream left plenty of those workers without a hive. So you won't find me dreaming about a job on Wall Street. And most of my friends feel the same way. The big financial institutions need to work on their reputation before my generation signs over ours.
Lauren Silverman lives in Washington, D.C. Youth Radio produced her commentary. You can hear the final segment this weekend on Marketplace Money. How about this idea? Save a tree in Brazil, keep polluting here at home. A plan pending in Congress would allow some of America's biggest polluters to cancel out their emissions here if they buy up endangered forests around the globe. Some U.S. firms have already been doing that by sinking millions of dollars into a forest reserve in southern Brazil. And how has that gone over with the locals down there? Michael Montgomery has that story in collaboration with Mark Shapiro of the Center for Investigative Reporting.
If you want to save a forest in Brazil, you might call on the services of the state's Força Verde, or Green Police. Recently, five Green Police troopers set out on a patrol of a nature reserve in the vast Atlantic Forest. Three big U.S. companies, American Electric Power, Chevron, and GM, invested millions of dollars to protect 50,000 acres of land here. It's a very 21st century idea. These companies don't own the land or the trees. They own credit for the carbon stored in the trees, and someday they hope to use it to cancel out some of their greenhouse gas pollution back home. The team's commander leads us through tall grasses and into the forest, where orchids grow wild and jaguars prowl. The Green Police are here to make sure that no one is cutting down trees. They've chased off land developers and poachers, but locals complain the Green Police are also targeting them.
If I go there, I'll be humiliated in front of my family because I'll be arrested. I'll be called a thief.
That's Jonas da Silva. He grew up on the reserve's border. The subsistence farmer says now he can't hunt or fish or even use the forest paths that the community has relied on for generations. Da Silva lives among some 10,000 farmers, fishermen, and Indians who eke out a living from the land. On a small island near the reserve, we meet up with Leonardo Huaratupa. The Guarani tribal leader has watched with apprehension as American companies cordon off the land here in the name of fighting climate change.
When those lands end up in the hands of environmentalists who say they want to preserve them, it ends up limiting many things for the people around, and the local population suffers.
It is denying them access to land that they have used for many generations and which they have maintained and preserved.
Jutta Kill of the British environmental group Fern has compiled extensive testimony from dozens of locals who complain about abuses by police and park rangers.
We heard of people being arrested. We heard of people having their produce confiscated. And we heard of the increasing difficulty of sustaining their families, and therefore a number of families have also had to leave the area.
Kill says some people fled to Antonina. That's a small town a few miles outside the reserve. Carlos Machada is Antonina's mayor.
Directly or indirectly, it was through these conservation projects that the population came here and created a ring of poverty around our city. It's caused a big social problem here.
Machado calls these displaced people carbon refugees, but environmental groups managing the reserve see it differently.
Forests are the lungs of our planet.
In a promotional video, the U.S. Nature Conservancy, which brokered this deal, says its forest projects in Brazil are
offering local communities economic alternatives that are compatible with forest protection.
Duncan Marsh directs international climate policy for the Conservancy. He says the group's work in the reserve has given the community dozens of new jobs with health benefits, where before there were virtually none.
Most of those jobs are jobs with the full range of benefits, whereas a lot of these people were not necessarily employed in a full and fully compensated way prior to the existence of the project.
Marsh described retraining locals to sell things like organic bananas and honey. But the Nature Conservancy's own manager in Brazil told us that most money for job programs ran out a couple years ago. Now even some of the project's own corporate backers concede that mistakes were made.
I wasn't there in the early go, but I would imagine we came in as American companies frequently do. Everybody get out of the way. We're going to do this.
That's Mike Morris, CEO of American Electric Power, one of the country's biggest utilities. Morris says he's still excited about the idea of preserving forests to cancel out some of AEP's greenhouse gas emissions. But he says moving forward, the company will do things differently.
Our effort will be never to repeat those endeavors, but to go in as a willing partner and a participant after conversations with the local folks and the governmental folks involved to make certain that there's agreement with what we're doing.
Climate legislation making its way fitfully through Congress now includes a provision to respect the rights of people who live off forest land. But it remains to be seen whether companies only pay lip service or find a way to protect the forest people as fiercely as they do the trees. With Mark Shapiro, I'm Michael Montgomery for Marketplace.
Our story was produced in collaboration with the PBS program Frontline World. Check out some video from Brazil's Atlantic Forest on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. ConstantContact.com. By Microsoft, offering cloud computing for businesses with solutions for managing the transition to the cloud while managing costs for customers at Microsoft.com/cloud services. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
As we wrap things up on this Friday, let's take a moment to review. Not the major news of the week, but the items that didn't quite make the headlines, courtesy of Brendan Noonan, Rico Galliano, and select members of the Marketplace staff.
George Judson, managing editor, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Angry snowmen.
What do snowmen have to be angry about right now? This is the best year ever for them.
Well, they're standing outside the state capitol in Michigan, where legislators have to raise taxes to cover the budget. Protesters showed up. They built anti-tax snowmen. One held a sign that said, "I'm mad and I vote."
Do snowmen actually have a vote in Michigan?
They may now.
Amy Scott, New York Bureau Chief, what's your story?
Designer abductions.
Is this a new store or a new club?
Well, it's a new French company that will allow people to pay about $1,200 to be kidnapped.
What? Who would use such a service?
Apparently, it's corporate executives who are, I guess, tired of bungee jumping, so they'll pay for the adrenaline rush of being bound and gagged and held for up to 11 hours.
So this raises the question, what does the executive of the kidnapping company do for thrills?
I don't know, goes on vacation to Hawaii?
Yeah, like plays horseshoes, has a light beer.
Stacey Vanek-Smith, senior reporter, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
Well, a Bollywood filmmaker is offering $10,000 to anyone who can sit through his horror movie called Funk 2 and make it through to the end without freaking out and leaving.
Funk 2, the sequel to Funk.
Yeah, the sequel to Funk 1.
So it's that scary? Is it like 2 solid hours of Congress trying to pass a bill?
Yeah, Funk actually translates to C-SPAN.
I can't watch anymore!
There's more of what Rico and Brendan can do on their podcast. It's called The Dinner Party Download. There's a link on our website, marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow gained 4 points, a fraction of a percent. The Nasdaq also added 4 points, a tenth of 1%. The S&P 500 rose 1 point, a tenth of 1%. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money. Between slow sales and tons of foreclosures, some condo buildings feel like ghost towns.
I was having a fear of waking up one morning and I'd be the only one in the building. This just scared me.
I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join us back here Monday.
American Public Media.
all over the country.
We need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.